must have been so. Well, I think it ought to have been so.
And then I can remember horrible stories you used to tell about the nurse who made you have cod liver oil and you spilled it on your nuts. And
yes.
She made you have your nuts as well.
No, wait a minute, you're slightly wrong. It wasn't cod liver oil because we were vegetarian. It was some stuff called Yardil.
Oh, well, it's just.
I don't know whether you've ever heard of Yardil. It was pretty horrible. It was
like sort of
ghastly stuff. It was the same sort of thing as cod liver oil. And I had grape nuts for breakfast.
Oh, yes.
Those were the nuts.
Mm.
And because I didn't want my Yardil, I pushed it on one side and it fell over my grape nuts. And my grape nuts were kept until tea time. And then put in front of me the next day, still with this Yardil on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not the sort of thing my mother would have done, you see.
Mm.
She wouldn't have done that, and had she known. But of course, one didn't split to your mother about what the nurse was doing. It wasn't done. You had this sort of loyalty.
Yes.
This, by the way, is a picture of them in the on the broad.
Oh, that's an awfully good picture.
Mm.
Yeah.
I enjoyed keeping that. That's the one I was looking for.
Absolutely splendid photograph. What was the date of that?
I don't know, but she can't have been all that straight-laced, can she? She must have been very broad-minded then.
But I suppose, in a way, the nurse was responsible for discipline, really, and your mother's figure sort of removed above all that.
Yes. My mother didn't have to worry about the discipline. She was... it was done for her. What she'd have done if we had been naughty and she'd been solely responsible for us, I don't know. She was very, very much against smacking or any corporal punishment of any sort. Although I'm told regularly about the time at Saltburn when... Do you know Saltburn?
No, I don't, actually.
Well, there's a very steep path up the... cliff from the lower promenade to the upper promenade, the winding road, and we were walking up it. I couldn't have been more than three, I don't think, because I don't remember it. I wanted to hold her hand, and my brother was holding her hand, and I howled all the way, and I was never allowed to forget this, but she didn't ever talk about it with any anger. It was more fun, as though she treated it with fun. I don't think that she would have got upset had we been naughty.
Mm.
She'd have found some way round.
It does make motherhood so relatively easy, doesn't it? If you can delegate all the nasty parts of bringing up children and just be nice for an hour in the evening. but still, all the same, I mean, it was very common at that social level, wasn't it, to bring up children?
Yes, she carried on a little bit longer in her... with her middle class background, perhaps longer than many other emancipated women as herself. She carried on with it a little longer, partly because of my father having plenty of money. And even when he lost his money...
Partly because he put her on a pedestal.
Yes,
anyway.
He did.
That was his
wish.
Yes,
was very largely his fault.
Yes.
He wouldn't hear of her doing anything at any time. Going to fetch anything if she left something upstairs, he'd tear up for her. And he'd be there, she'd only lift one leg, and he'd be there with a footstool and have the footstool under both her feet, and she would sit there in her armchair with her feet on a footstool. Always he'd put it there. And yet, my sister was very close to my father, and she tells me that she didn't give him sufficient support when he was bankrupt, that he worried a great deal that he couldn't give her what she was used to, and she didn't make the effort. This is something I knew nothing about.
Yes. Wasn't there a phase where you sort of tried to run your house as a boarding house?
Yes, she did. She ran it first as a private school. And she got the children of gentlemen and gentle ladies there, paying quite a lot, with her socialist beliefs. Of course, the very idea of a private school surely must have been very contradictory.
Which house was this?
The Grey House. We started at Agecroft, actually. before we left Agecroft, and there was one girl I remember who was very rude many times, and her parents asked her to come to become a boarder at the school. This Joyce Fawcett, I think her name was then, and she took advantage of the fact that her parents had her father was William Fawcett, and he was knighted for some work, obviously very very Tory, blue Tory he was, and she took advantage of the fact that he was a knight, and she knew there was financial difficulty at home, and she used to lord it over us and over me, and I hated her very guts, but she boarded in the school, in the house, in order to attend the school during the daytime. Now I didn't attend the school. I was at that time going to school at the local grammar school, secondary school.
It was more a primary school, was it, that your mother ran?
Yes,
young children.
Yes, although Joyce must have been older. She must have been 14, 15, I think, by that time. That was, I remember, a very difficult patch. And I think the fact that the school, she got the wrong type of people in the school, and eventually they all dispersed, and the school fell through. I think it went on for about 3 years or so.
She taught herself, was she, in the school? I mean,
she taught special subjects, not a great deal. Somebody called Miss McKinley used to teach most of the time, and there was a very attractive woman who taught dancing to them. I can't remember, Miss Daniels. And my mother taught occasionally the very special subjects. And she would occasionally sing hymns with them.
So she was really presiding over something rather than other people again, in a way.
Yes. She didn't really work very hard at it. And then we started running the house as a boarding house, paying guests. It was never called a boarding house. They were paying guests. And we had the long table with the various people around. They, generally speaking, I think there was one headmistress, there was another one who was a French teacher at the high school, and there were other people who had a certain standing before they became paying guests. And Daddy used to sit at one end of the table and my mother would sit at the other. And quite definitely they were guests. And there was the servant, as usual, going round with the tureens and serving. It was almost as though it was a dinner party every night.
So it's a way of keeping your existing standard of living, but getting more money.
Yes. And then there were terrible moments when she would be away, or I don't know why, but there were odd times when she wasn't there. And when my sister was at the university, and the awful time when I had to sit at the head of the table. I was terrified and tongue-tied. Oh, the meals, I couldn't get them over quick enough.
What she's really saying, do correct me if I'm wrong, is that she didn't really put herself out to get the financial situation right then. I mean, she didn't really alter her way of living.
She didn't. But she did what she thought was best. She was trying to earn money, in a way that she would fit in with the social standing that she had. Then, eventually, when it was all finished with, and after my father's death, she did take a job, the only job that I've ever known her to take. I think she found that she couldn't make ends meet, and she must have been all of 58, or thereabouts at the time, and she became an organiser for the NUWT.
Yes, I did, I'd forgotten that.
And I was already in Leicester then, and she came to stay with me quite often, because she did travelling, going by train and bus. It must have been awfully hard work for her, something that I don't really know how she stood it. She must have been doing it for about a year or more. And during that time, because she was earning money, she spent money too. I remember her buying me lots of underwear and all sorts of things that she couldn't possibly have afforded.
It's funny feeling, isn't it? Yes. Money, I'm crossing your fingers.
But she did. She spent money, and then she had a terrible jolt because she had a huge income tax. It was before the pay as you earn, she got this enormous income tax bill. And I don't quite know how that was ever settled. I think she went on paying it for years after she'd given up the job.
Was she not good with money, would you say? I mean, presume your father managed it all, the household money.
Now then, this is what's the matter with the family generally.
Nobody's any good with money.
Nobody's good with money.
It's there to
be my brother was. My father would give his last penny away. He never had any money in his pocket. Anybody could ask him for money and he'd give everything he had away. She always used to say this very proudly. But she used to say too that she was the one who had to look after the housekeeping bills. But then she looked after them in such an unusual manner, in such a lavish manner, you can say. Mm.
Well, presumably she had never had to economise
her married life. No. She did criticise him that he would give every penny away. And, of course, when she had money, she too did the same. And it wasn't until her last 10 years or so she began to get on top of things financially. She had a little bit of money left her by a sister-in-law. And it was enough to buy an annuity for her, and with the odd little extras that she managed to invest in, she kept above the surface. She had a pension, a teacher's pension, a very, very small one.
Did she really?
Yes, tiny little teacher's pension. I don't know how much it was, but it was almost negligible.
I meant to ask you, if you was a trained teacher, did she actually teach you in the home as children? Or
no.
She never sort of was her own governess sort of thing?
No, she never did that.
Mm.
No. She never attempted to as grandchildren either.
Didn't she?
No. She was always very correct in that you must say this and you must say that. And my
you
spelling.
Mean against dialect?
Yes. Yeah. And you must always stand straight. And my spelling was incredibly bad, and every letter I ever wrote to her, long after I left home, I would read over and over again, and I would often find that I'd gone round a sentence rather than use a word that I didn't know how to spell.
It
became a sort of obsession with me, because I knew that the next letter I got from her, she would be correcting my spelling in the previous letter, you see. And this embarrassed me to such an extent that I would go to all sorts of ends to try and circumvent it. So in that, to that extent, she was always the teacher.
Yes. Mm. But not a disciplinarian in a traditional sense at all.
No.
Because the servants did the disciplining.
Yes, she was never.
Did she get on with the servants, actually?
No.
I mean,
no, she didn't.
If she treated them like this, in a way, I suppose...
They were always leaving.
They would take it,
they were always leaving.
Oh, were they really?
Yes, there was a constant changeover. But there was one called Agnes, who came and went and came and went and came back again and went again. There was a sort of love-hate relationship between her and my mother. And in the end, when Agnes died, my mother was by her bedside in the hospital. And then it was, the hate was all dropped. That was the only one of the servants. And there was one called Gertie who came through thick and thin, about the last one we ever had before my father died. Gertie came early in the morning, did absolutely everything. She really was imposed upon terribly. She was one of these people whose father had benefited by something that my mother had done at some time and through the Labour Party, came from down Cannon Streetway in Middlesbrough. And so she worshipped my mother and she would do anything for her. But it was very much mistress and servant.
And do you think that's why they left, really? They felt that she didn't really... She gave herself airs, or whatever the
word
would be.
Yes, and she was quick to Laura, another one we had, who was very hot-tempered, quick-tempered. She resented being told, do this. My mother would say, oh, go and do that, do this. You know, she wouldn't say please. She found it very difficult to say please, even to the end.
Independent sort of thing, you know?
Even in the home, she didn't say please, and it got the backs up of the attendants there. She would ask in all sorts of ways without having to say please. She would try and get an inflection in her voice which would be saying please, but she wouldn't actually say please, and some people wouldn't understand that the inflection in her voice, in fact, was asking as nicely as she could. But because she didn't say please, she would be offending them.
And is that basically because she just hates being dependent on people, and if you say please, in a sense, you admit your dependence on them?
I think that could be so.
I mean, you know her better than I do. I just want to try and see why.
The thing is, I haven't analysed her. You always find it difficult to analyse one's mother to that extent. You see, she'd never say please to me, but then I wouldn't expect it from her at all. If I said to Paula, oh, go and do the washing up, you'd sit there and not move. But my mother would say, oh, Alice, go and do the washing up, will you? And I'd get up, and I wouldn't notice that she hadn't said please, and it's only in latter years that I remember that she never did.
She was very independent, was she? I mean,
yes,
her own boss all the time.
She didn't like moving from Middlesbrough to Derby, did she?
No, she didn't.
I think that was a bad move, really, although it was for her own sake.
But it's like she came, she clashed with my brother's wife.
I'm not quite with that. She moved to your brother's, didn't she? When she was older.
In Derby, yes. And as she'd always been the mistress of the house, she found it very difficult to live with my brother's wife. She had got she had got her own room. They had fixed her up in her own room. But she didn't stay up there. She wanted to be with the rest of the family. And although Doreen leaned over backwards to do a great deal for her, there was this undercurrent of criticism the whole time, between both of them. Perhaps more so from my mother than from Doreen. And after all, she wasn't Doreen's mother. And
so that lasted, what, for a few years, didn't it?
Yes.
And then she went back to live opposite the hospital,
she stayed there until my brother died when you were 14, wasn't it?
Dale
was 16. And then she went back to this bungalow near the hospital in Greenwich Close. And she lived there alone. And she had lots of people there. I think she was happy there. People used to come and see her. Of course, she took it as a just right that people would do things for her. The lady who lived over the road brought her Sunday dinner over for her. She started doing it. She wasn't asked to, but she started doing it because she felt a little sorry for her. She never did any cooking of her own. And then it became such an established fact that if anybody else was going to be there for Sunday dinner, she'd send an order over the road for a bit more, you see.
She paid this one.
No. But then she didn't see anything wrong in it.
She must have had a lot of charm if people would do this.
She had immense charm.
Yes. Well, you can't get away with that unless you give something in return.
No, she had immense charm. This she did have. And you felt this. Ray only knew her for a year before she died, and it wasn't her best time. But I can say that he absolutely adores the memory of her. He's heard all that I've ever said about her. And the very fact that she criticized him so charmingly made him love her. Your husband, Roger, he always managed to get on very well with her, didn't he?
Again, perhaps, because he wasn't used to this
being told to do something without saying please, and so he would wait for it. And he didn't have an awe as perhaps the rest of us did.
No. And she accepted him, and I know when we used to move from one room to another, Roger's arm would be ready for her to take, always. He'd be the first one there, wouldn't he? I noticed this. Didn't you notice it? Have you seen that one, Amber?
Mind you, when he's in class, he talks to all ladies and gentlemen.
She's the one at this end.
Oh, yes.
There, you recognise her, do you?
This is presumably a Saturday.
I think that was at Gisborough. The same Gisborough.
Yes. It's a very good photograph. Again, you have got some very good photographs.
Yes, we have.
But you kept saying that she was very middle class or something. What do you mean? How would you notice her middle classness then? I mean, what would it be, dress or what? I mean, or would she constantly be commenting on people's behaviour, which showed
No, that she never stooped to.
No.
She was above such things as commenting on anyone else or anyone else's dress or anyone else's behaviour.
Mm.
Oh, no. No, it was just the way she spoke. An inflection in her voice.
And Roger said it was the way she sat as well.
Yes, it was an aura around her.
Mm.
And it was always... she was very knowledgeable and had complete confidence in herself. I can honestly say that she was... I think of her as a left-wing intellectual. You know, there's that song about my parents were left-wing intellectuals. You know, the chap who sings in the pub. What's his name? The Northerner.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yes. But then there was there's a book of Iris Murdoch's who she describes. Is it the girl who had a limp? Which one is it? Who goes to... she is a deformed girl, and they've decided that she's the youngest in the family, and they've decided that she really is a bit of a failure, but in fact she goes to live with a young man. I think he was an artist. I've forgotten the gist of the story, but her parents too, very much the left-wing intellectuals, as I think of my parents. But the mother was one who lacked femininity, and always when I hear people talk about their parents in that way, as middle class, I always feel that the mother is a little less than feminine for some reason. Almost as though she wears flower hats and has a rather hard voice and is a little less than feminine. Now, my mother was totally feminine.
Yes.
Absolutely, totally feminine.
Mm.
In every
with dress, I mean, she was fond of clothes, was she?
She liked clothes, but she didn't dress very... In the days when she had money, she had nice clothes, not ostentatious, but she had the same clothes for years and years and years. She always managed to wear them.
Had a shawl.
Yes, she always looked feminine in the same old thing.
Possibly it was the hairstyle as well. She always kept her hair long and had
There is a lovely photograph of her.
Yes, that's lovely, isn't it? Beautiful. Again, a very good profile there.
It's, in a way, it shows how feminine and how much she loved, and yet it's, it cuts right across the side of her that was the public side.
Yes, yes. She has a sort of warmth that you wouldn't expect, in a way. Yes, that's true. Was she was fond of family occasions and family things, was she? I mean, she valued
her birthdays.
Did she?
She loved birthdays. There was never a time when she would miss a birthday. And we had Miss Moody. My father's mother had a housekeeper. And this was Miss Moody. And Miss Moody, I think my father's mother was very autocratic. A very autocratic old lady. And she used to absolutely walk over Miss Moody. But Miss Moody recognized her worth. Apparently the old lady was one of these people with a heart of gold but terribly autocratic. I tend to criticize anybody who is like that because I always wonder why they should be so, but nevertheless. Miss Moody, because my father was the last one to marry, tended to keep an eye on him, and so she always was part of the family in a way. She was a sort of background to the family, and my mother treated Miss Moody very much as a friend. Not a social friend, she was a friend within the
family
circle.
Kind of thing, yeah.
Yes. Mm. And every birthday that we had as children, Miss Moody would come the day before and usually stay overnight, and she would bring a cake, a beautiful big cake, and there'd be great ceremonies of icing, and my mother would be there as well. Miss Tate, the cook, would also make a cake, but hers somehow was always inferior to Miss Moody's, whether it really was or not, I don't know, but it had to be. Sometimes it was iced much more beautifully than Miss Moody's, but it was inferior. Miss Moody's was the special one. And my mother had a great sense of occasion then, and at Christmas time we had a nice big house, and so we had lots of friends on Christmas Eve, children. We used to have about 40 friends of neighbours, children of neighbours rather, all around. They were mostly doctors and dentists, children and people like that, all round about. They had to have a certain social standing. And they came to our party. Sometimes it was in fancy dress. It was a very big affair. We had the nursery upstairs, and there was a big tree in the nursery that always touched the ceiling. It was beautifully lit up, and there were presents all over it. And after tea, well, we'd have tea down in the dining room, and that would be a long table, and there'd be crackers with standing round snowmen in the middle. All the way along, or a clown or a snowman, all the way down the table. And she'd have great long runners on the table, big white tablecloths and a long coloured runner down the centre. She had all these things. Very, very exciting it was. You know, she really went to town about these things. And we'd have a lovely time in that beautiful dining room of ours at Agecroft. And then we'd go upstairs, and the excitement would really reach a sort of pitch, because Father Christmas was coming. And in fact, year after year, somebody was Father Christmas to this children's party. To me as a child, I went on to quite an age after most children, believing in Father Christmas, because he was there, he came in. The lights were dimmed, there was just the light of the tree and nothing else, and he came in with the presents, and it was all done like that. So she had a great sense of the occasion.
I mean, you'd think that she'd be too busy to organise that sort of thing, wouldn't you?
No. We were very important to her. She was not too busy in that respect. Those sort of things we had. So that really childhood was, it was wonderful. My childhood with her was really wonderful, although she didn't wash my socks and mend my clothes.
That really is a tribute, isn't it? Because, because in a way, I suppose it is easier for that generation to combine the two, but the great problem for women, isn't it, if they're in public life, is they've always got their families dragging them back to do things.
They have,
given
them
the attitude that men have. But, I mean, you didn't feel with her that there was really a conflict between the two at all?
No. Mm. No, and when she went to Italy, she went to Rome for a big conference of women. Marion will probably tell you more about it.
Yes.
The date to me is so dim and distant.
Yes, I know the one you mean. Yes.
But I remember, I've got pictures somewhere of the conference, and they're all wearing their sashes across their shoulders. She's somewhere, but I never have discovered where she was in the picture. When she came back, the tenseness of the 2 days before she came back, she was coming, and she came. And the opening of the boxes of presents that she brought back for us, it was absolutely wonderful. It was unforgettable. And she enjoyed it so much.
How did she organise her time? I mean, when you were a child, really. I mean, you didn't really see her except for the hour between 5 and 6.
In the morning, she got up late. She had breakfast in bed, always.
Brought by your father? No,
by
servants.
Yes. and she'd read the paper. And then she'd get up, and she had mysterious correspondence. She would go into the morning room, and I couldn't enter the morning room ever, because she had a big desk in that room. It was a lovely room. But she had this desk, and she got on with her correspondence. And I should have lunch. In the afternoon, she generally had a lie down. She often used to say she had a headache. She had all sorts of... she was a hypochondriac.
Was she really?
Mm. Oh, yes. Wasn't she? As a result, we will not take any pills. We'll take no medicine or anything, Marion and I, and nor Paula. As a complete opposite reaction, mm. Yes. You were sort of gentle and kind to her. She'd sit by the fire with a shawl on and read to me, even though she got a headache, during the hour. What she did in the afternoons, I'm not really sure. She would go down to the Red Cross that she started nursing the welfare for the mothers and babies. She'd go down there. She'd do a lot of work for the council.
In the afternoons? Yes.
And of course she was a magistrate, and once a week she always went to South Bank to the magistrate's court.
I can remember that as well.
Do you remember that?
Yes, when we used to go for holidays and she used to go off and we'd wait and ask her, what happened today? Who did you send to prison? You know, as children were. I don't know whether she ever told us the truth about it.
Well,
probably not.
Probably not. She didn't want to know the sordid side.
So her day was quite full in what would now seem a rather leisurely way, but then I suppose she was much busier than most women were.
She must have been. And the evenings, she and my father did a lot of entertaining in the drawing room, but I wasn't there.
What sort of business entertaining?
It might have been my father's business friends. Mm. It could well have been. But we were up in the night nursery, and I know they had rather nice things to eat, and we used to be allowed to slip downstairs in our nighters into the kitchen and sample things and then slip upstairs again, you see, and not interfere with anybody. And this used to happen quite a lot, I can remember that. So she had a very full life, I believe.
Mm. Because most women, my mother was sort of middle class or more or less, I suppose it's difficult to define these things. Mm. But, you know, she never thought of having a job until she was about 40. Women didn't.
No.
Whereas your mother, if 40 or I, she obviously wouldn't think of having employment or any permanent job after marriage.
This wasn't part of their life at all. It just wasn't taken into consideration. At all. She certainly, as I look back and I put all these things together, I can see her. I've so often talked about her to you and you knew her, but it's only fragmentary and it's rather nice suddenly to talk about her and build up a picture.
What do you think, looking back at this business of your father putting a footstool under her feet, what do you think about that in retrospect? I mean, do you think he overdid it and encouraged this hypochondria in her, do you think, by that sort of thing? I suppose he was very fond of her.
I think he wouldn't have done otherwise.
No.
If she were to marry and have a happy marriage, she obviously had to have somebody like that.
Mm.
Had there been anybody who said to her, oh, do it yourself, or... one cross word from my father and she was devastated. I remember there was a time around his bankruptcy when I think they did have violent words. He must have been terribly, terribly worried, and he went out for all 12 hours or so, and I think he was walking around the countryside, and he came back and everything was wonderful again. But that is about the only time I ever remember any crosswords between them as a child. But then I didn't see them all that much. But there never seemed to be, because they each respected each other so. And I, th- I think she loved him, but he, his was the greater, his was the idolizing, the worshipping, yes, and she took it as her right.
You see, there you've got another contradiction in a way, haven't you, because an emancipated woman doesn't expect to be worshipped by men. There's a sort of equality in the relationship, isn't there?
Yes.
A lot of them, in a sense, if you're worshipped, it means that you're limited, you're kept in a glass case, that sort of thing.
But of course he didn't do that with her. He worshipped her and he supported her in all her campaigns.
That is when he first saw her, isn't it?
She was already organising. Mm. He would always say that he walked into his sister's house and he saw this woman sitting on the hearthrug with a lot of hair, the colour of ripe corn, he said, this beautiful young woman. And within a month or so, I think 2 months, they were married. It was a very quick courtship.
So he met her via Mrs. Coates Hanson,
yes.
Did he?
That's what I always understood.
Did you realize, yes.
She had come to organize some meetings for the suffragettes. And of course from then on, Daddy followed all the meetings around, I believe, from then on.
Mm.
But then he always, Mrs. Coates Hanson, Auntie Marion, had already started, done a lot for the movement before she came. So he was already very much on their side by that time.
What about, can you tell me anything about Mrs. Coates Hanson? I mean, she's an interesting figure in her own right, isn't she? She was a much more forcible person.
Yes, she was. She was a great character. She had an extremely happy marriage with Uncle Friedrich, who was
the Dane,
Schleswig-Holstein. There is a history of a sort of eczema in the family, and she had it very badly. Your cousin Helen has it, and my daughter's little girl has it. It is in the family, this history of eczema. Now, Aunt Marion had eczema badly in her hands, and she and Uncle Friedrich, whom apparently she met in America, they were associated with the Felsnaptha soap people there. She said she wouldn't, that they must never have children, they must never pass this on. And she told me that their marriage was never consummated, and they were married for about 30 years. And she told me quite definitely that it never was, and they were idyllically happy. He was always the husband of Mrs. Coates Hanson. Perhaps that explains it. You know, the husband of Mrs. Coates Hanson. And she was, I think she was an alderman. Yes, she was an alderman in Middlesbrough, eventually. And he was always behind her. He was always there and supporting her. And he was my father's partner in the coal exporting business. It was, what was it? Ronnebeck, Hanson, Coates and Vettestrand, I think it was. There was, Ronnebeck was the chief partner, Hanson, Uncle Friedrich, Coates, Daddy, and Vettestrand, a Swedish man. So it was very mixed nationalities.
So they had money as well?
Yes, and when the bankruptcy happened, they came out of it without Uncle Friedrich becoming bankrupt. Daddy was bankrupt. Well, it was a breakup of the firm, you see. Daddy was bankrupt, but Uncle Friedrich wasn't. They kept their lovely house at Nunthorpe. Eventually they sold it, and they lived in smaller places. Now, they always delighted, Auntie Marion delighted in she and Uncle Friedrich between them doing their own housework. And they worked together and they did everything together. And she used to love to tell me how Friedrich, as she called him, Friedrich, she did call him Friedrich, would do this for her and that for her. But she also knew that she did little things for him too. They were highly domesticated.
More modern in a way.
No, they weren't modern at all. They were not at all. But they were domesticated, and they took a great pride in their antiques and their polished cutlery and all that sort of thing. And they had some lovely possessions. They had spent a lot of money, and had a lot of money, and all their money, instead of having children, had gone into collecting antiques and possessions. And, then they did give my father the opportunity to have some self-respect and a job when the paying guests and the school and everything had failed and there was simply no money at all. They took him into their little business. Oh, what was it? It was a sort of agency. And he was nothing else but a glorified office boy, really. His pride must have suffered terribly. But it never, ever came through. You knew that he was probably eating himself up inside for feeling that he wasn't pulling his weight, that he'd let, in a way, he felt he'd let Mummy down. But he still had, he too had incredible charm. And at the very end, I think he was only earning just about as much as an office boy would earn. And there was the accident, you see, when Uncle Friedrich was driving. But Aunt Marion, my father's, she was an older, a younger sister. She was younger than he was. I think she, no, she wasn't a nurse. I don't know what she was in the first place. Oh, she was a governess, that's it. She was governess to the children of Mary Fells. Fells. Joseph Fells.
I see.
She went out as governess to the children in America.
And that's how she how she met her husband? No.
I don't know really how they met, but she was over there, and Uncle Walter was very friendly with Joseph Fells, that was Aunt Marion's brother, my father's brother. And the Fells had adopted, Joseph and Mary Fells had adopted this Eleanor, who eventually married my Uncle Walter. She was the singer, an opera singer, quite a prima donna.
Eleanor Coates, did she sing?
She became Eleanor Coates, yes. I don't know what her name was when she sang. She sang in Berlin and all over, but she apparently was very well known. It's all delving into the dim past.
There were three brothers, were there Walter?
Oh, no, there were about 10 of them.
Oh, were there really?
Yes, there was Uncle Will, who married a barmaid, and this wasn't talked about at all. No, and they had a daughter who in the end became my mother's staunchest supporter, really, at the end. Nell.
Nell?
She was wonderful. She was nearly as old as my mother. She died. Well, that was Uncle Will. And then there was, my father was the second one. Uncle Tom, Uncle Bob, who went to America, and I think he was the connection with America in the first place, but he got lost. He would come up with some sort of patent or invention or something with a bit of money, and then eventually get lost, and then he'd come up again. And Uncle Walter always told me that he found him once very down and out, wearing about 6 pairs of socks to cover up the holes, you know, that sort of thing. So that was Uncle Bob, and then there was Uncle Tom, who was the farmer. And there were three sisters, there was Aunt Daisy, Aunt Betty, and Auntie Marion. Auntie Marion was Mr. Coates Hanson. Auntie Betty was about 80 when she had a book, her first book published.
On what, actually?
Letters of somebody or other she wrote.
Edited letters?
They were ones that she made. It was something, a fantasy of her own.
Oh, I see.
But it was Letters of Tabitha or something. Anyway, it was published. And at the age of 80, that's quite an achievement. She was a nurse. She had nursed my Uncle Alf, who was a Jew. And I think he fell in love with her and they married, and she would never, until her dying, well, right to the end, she would never tell him how old she was, because she was older than he was. And he had to come and ask my father, when he was filling in a census form, how old she was, in fact. This shows you a little bit of the character of the of the family.
How did your mother get on with Mrs. Coates Hanson? I mean,
they never really did get on very well, because Mrs. Coates Hanson hadn't got the femininity, Aunt Marion, as I call her, hadn't got the femininity of my mother, although she was domesticated and loyal in a way to Uncle Friedrich. She had a very hot temper. A very, very hot temper, which of course my mother hadn't got at all. I never remember my mother losing her temper. She had no temper. But Auntie Marion had, and Auntie Marion had migraines too. I think she said many things about my mother. She criticised my mother being undomesticated too. She criticised her about doing nothing around the house. So there was this friction between them.
It must have been a dreadful business, your mother in the end ending up, in a sense, dependent on her.
She didn't like it.
I'm sure she couldn't.
She didn't like it at all.
It really was the ultimate humiliation.
She wasn't happy, and I often think how unhappy her last years have been. And then going to the home, and in fact the matron at the home, being such an uncompromising person.
Was she? I was rather impressed by her.
You saw Mrs. Dougal, I think.
No, I don't remember who I saw.
Mrs. Pryor.
But anyway, I thought the home itself was rather nice.
Well, Mrs. Pryor, who was the matron right till the last year, she would never accept the fact that my mother had done these things. My mother was just a patient along with the others, and my mother wanted to impress upon Mrs. Pryor that she was different, that she was not the same as all the others. And Mrs. Pryor wouldn't have it, and so as a result, perhaps she was right, but she was hard. There has been a matron in Leicester recently who's been relieved of her post at her home. And in fact, it was so bad that Marion and I both tried to. We wrote to the health authorities in Middlesbrough repeatedly about Mrs. Pryor, because we felt that she was unjust to not only my mother but to others as well. Then none of them were happy with her.
She didn't accept the fact that their brains were still alive.
No, she didn't. She treated
them as human individuals. She didn't accept them.
She didn't.
Your mother sort of had intellectual liveliness. Did she write till the end of her life?
Yes. And Mrs. Dougal, who came after Mrs. Pryor, was completely the opposite. She accepted these things about all the people in her care, and my mother in particular, and she was kindness itself. Now, when the fear was that my mother would become infirm and not able to get out of bed and will be bedridden entirely. And Mrs. Pryor said, you can't stay here if you're bedridden. You have to go to a geriatric hospital. And this was a threat being held over Granny. And of course, Granny's spirit was in no way defeated. She was battling away against this the whole time. But it wasn't nice, and it was horrible. And I used to have a lump in my throat when I left her. I would go and sit with her when I went up every month to see her, and I'd sit the whole of Sunday with her in the home. You were allowed to do that. But when Mrs. Dougal came there, she said, of course she'll stay here till the end. There's no question of it. She'll be perfectly all right. And when Granny was ill at the end, there was someone in attendance the whole time, just sitting beside her bed and holding her hand. When Marion and I were not there, there was always somebody there. Kindness itself.
Yes, as I say, I got the impression it was a very good place.
And yet, how could someone like Mrs. Pryor have had the job first? And it wasn't happy, was it?
Talking about your Aunt Coates Hanson and your mother, Your sister had a marvellous story, and I'm sure she wouldn't mind me passing on to you about, no doubt you'll remember it. Apparently you both had dogs, both family had dogs, and they used to be exercised together, rather at the same time they'd fight. rather symbolic of the relationship between
the Yes, that's true, very true.
I can't remember the names of the dogs now.
But there was Carlo, was one.
Carlo, that's right. Yeah.
And I've forgotten what Tante Marion's dog was called. Yes, I know. Actually, Aunt Marion used to live next door, I think, to us. There's that one where the house where I was born. Do you know what happened? Oh, there it is. Wilstrup House. This is the house where they went when they were first married.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, the corner house, and it's not all of that. That's where
it's from there. Isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Somewhere around about there.
Yeah.
That's where Daddy and Mummy went when they were first married.
Mm.
And Aunt Marion lived in one joining on to it, the other half, so to speak.
Yes.
And so their proximity was not comfortable, perhaps.
What about your careers? I mean, was she ambitious for you, all three children, would you say, your mother?
Very ambitious. Very. I was a disappointment to her. Because the other two had got to the university. Money ran out. I think maybe that was largely so, but in any event, I hadn't got the brain to get to the university. And but as a result of that, my sister tells me that she was, in a way, more fond of me. My sister's always had this little jealousy. She admitted it to me just the last time I was with her. She was always a little jealous because I always seemed to have my mother's affection, simply because I wasn't quite as brilliant as the other two and didn't pass examinations like they did. And then I actually got my matriculation, and they just couldn't believe it, and she was so proud about it. and I remember nobody had bothered when the results came through. I was getting the breakfast ready for the paying guests at the time, and my mother was having breakfast in bed, and I think she didn't want to know because they didn't think I would get through. And my father came down in his dressing gown and got the post. And I was standing in the kitchen with a frying pan and everything round me, very harassed. And he came in and he said, "I knew you'd do it, I knew you'd do it." And apparently I'd matriculated, not even just school certificate, which was something totally unexpected. And I think it was because of that they had this feeling that perhaps that I was a little less able to defend myself, possibly.
I don't know why. She warmed to you for that reason.
Yes, yeah. And Marion says that I could always get her to do things or soften her where she couldn't. I don't believe this is true, because Marion was absolutely wonderful to her right to the end, and Marion gave up a great deal, I know, of her own marriage in the early days because of looking after my mother. My mother demanded this of her.
Mm.
She demanded too much, I think, of Marion, or it may be that Marion gave too much.
And you've said recently that since Granny died, Marion has lost something.
Yes.
She's lost looking after somebody, Granny.
Yes.
You mean she feels a gap? You mean she feels emancipated?
No,
it's not an emancipation, it's a gap. She wants. She's had no children, you see. And she looked after Granny almost as though she were a child of hers, although with the respect of a daughter to a mother.
Yes.
And then after Granny dying, there was the gap, but at the same time, she needed someone to be dependent on her.
Mm.
And I think, in a way, it's brought her closer to me, because she feels now that with Ray and myself, with the difficulties which we're obviously having to face now, that I need help.
Yeah,
nothing
well,
else,
way,
but moral help, you know.
Yeah.
That's all. But she has warmed, hasn't she, Paula?
Mm.
Quite obviously. And she nearly had a breakdown last autumn.
Yes, and I had an odd letter from her, didn't I?
Yes.
I bet it's something like that. I didn't get the impression she...
She did. She said she was as near taking her own life as she'd ever been.
Mm.
And
she lost an awful lot of weight, didn't
yes.
she?
Yes. She lost 2 stone more in weight. She kept ringing me up every night. The phone would ring, and she just wanted to talk it out with me.
Mm.
And she said that she had a guilt complex about having criticised her mother so much in the last few years, and that she was short-tempered with her because she was not well. And she got this terrible guilt complex, and she didn't know what to do about it. And also the dog was so trying and always on her nerves. And she begged me, Andre, to go down, and Stan, her husband, came on the phone and invited us there. And Stan had been adamant that he would not accept Ray on moral grounds, you see. And he came over and he said, you and Ray will be very, very welcome.
Mm.
And that was the turning point.
Mm.
From then on, Marion knew that I was back in the fold, complete with Ray, and she gets on very, she's very fond of Ray, and strange enough, Stan is.
Mm.
He has now made up his mind that he's said what he felt, and Ray respects him for this, and they are now very good friends. In fact, he only rang Ray up a couple of days ago for his opinion on a new car that he was thinking of buying.
So in a way, I mean, it's rather odd, isn't it? But in a way, the death of your mother has, in fact, brought her family close together in an odd sort of way.
It has. It's also made Marion's and Stan's marriage happier than it used to be. There were times when it was very much on the rocks.
Mm.
And they are much closer now than I've ever known them.
Mm.
It has had quite a... in fact, she jumps down off the wall regularly, doesn't she? Have you seen that photograph up there?
No, that's it. He sounds a very gentle sort of person, and unassuming and so on.
He wasn't unassuming. He was a very forceful character. He was the master of the house. My mother was the mistress of the house. They shared it.
So it really was a partnership.
Yes, it was a partnership in that respect. He wasn't as gentle and unassuming as Auntie Marion's husband, Uncle Friedrich.
No.
There was none of that with Daddy.
No.
Daddy was, in fact, to me and to my sister, the ideal man. Until I met Ray, and I don't think Paula will mind me saying this.
No, but I always resented it.
I know you resented it, darling. Until I met Ray, I never found anyone who quite came up to Daddy. I do think I found it now.
Mm.
But nevertheless, he was wonderful. He was generous in the extreme. He was totally understanding. He was a man. 100% man.
Wise.
He was
wise.
Yes, and he couldn't have been anything else but a socialist. He could never have been anything else, being the sort of person he was.
Mm.
He was a capitalist only because of the world he was living in. But had he had the opportunity, I think he'd been very much a profit-sharing, you know.
Mm.
And he would have lived up wholly, and I think he did as far as it was possible within his world, to live wholly to his beliefs.
Mm.
And I can't say much more.
No, that's quite a lot, isn't it? Well, so, I mean, for instance, he wouldn't... He would get on with the servants all right, would he? I mean,
he got on with everybody. It was Charlie everywhere.
Was it really?
All over the town, it was Charlie that they would greet him as. The The men who were out of work down at the exchange, who used to wait there without any hope at all, he'd go down and talk to them. And he'd be going perhaps to his office, where he knew he was in the days when everything was quite comfortable. But he would always have a word with them, and they were his equals, and he was their equal too, and it was Charlie this and Charlie that. And Charlie used to be addressing meetings at street corners. Sometimes he was tub thumping away, and I've walked along as a child and remember seeing him, hearing him. And everybody, had they been disagreeing with him, they would listen to him because he was a good speaker. He used to get heckled a lot, but he took it in good part.
Did you ever hear your mother speak, actually, as a child? I only heard
her speaking at indoor meetings that were arranged. I never heard her in her campaigns when she must have been speaking at street corners. I never heard those.
Hmm.
No, but I did hear Daddy. I heard him in support of her, because in fact, when I was old enough, he was bankrupt and he wasn't allowed to stand as a bankrupt, you see. As an undischarged bankrupt.
Hmm.
But he was in support of her all the time.
They were a pair, weren't they? I mean, they were inseparable pair in the Labour Party locally, weren't
yes,
they? I mean, they,
yes.
they went together.
Oh, yes,
didn't they?
Always together.
You
would never think of them as separate in any way.
Mm.
No. No, there was not any competition between them at all.
Mm. They both supported each other,
yes,
sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah,
it was rather lovely in that respect.
Mm. Where does the vegetarianism come from? Who? Was your mother always a vegetarian from the beginning?
No, they embraced it when they got married. They were not vegetarian, I think, for about the first year of their marriage. But they became vegetarian, deciding that they were going to model their lives as they wanted to, and they had no need then to bother about other people, and they thought that vegetarianism as a way of life was good.
Not for health reasons, really, but for humanitarian reasons.
More both.
Mm.
Largely humanitarian as well as health. Mm. But it was both. My mother ran and got this. The health food stores, did Marion tell you this?
Yes,
the suffrage shop, it was called.
Yes.
Halfway along Linthorpe Road. It wasn't in the market, it was near where the co-op is. Do you know Middlesbrough?
I don't at all. It's sort of near the centre, is it, somewhere?
The co-op has taken over the block of buildings where the suffrage shop was, the big co-op centre.
Mm.
And she ran a cafe there as well, a vegetarian cafe. She had a manageress in there and all the rest of it. Of course, it lost money, like everything else.
But it was the suffrage shop that was converted into a vegetarian cafe, wasn't it? It started off as a suffrage place.
She called it the suffrage shop. I think she started it off as the vegetarian shop, as the health food shop. She leased it, I suppose, and there was a sort of arcade, and behind the shop was the within this arcade was the cafe.
And it
suffrage
was just a commercial.
Rooms, I think it was called.
Was it really? It was just a commercial.
And over the top, yeah, I believe there was a hall with suffrage rooms, which they used to use. They let out for various meetings to people. Can't have been a very big place, but I remember it very well.
So she stayed a vegetarian all her life, did she?
Mm.
Oh yes,
right.
Yes. Mm. Even in the home, and they gave her little triangles of cheese and nothing else for her dinner. They had no imagination whatsoever.
Mm.
Even if we brought them something, you know, the various vegetarian foods that you can buy are prepared, they just chop up the meat out of a tin and give it her cold and not bother about doing anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
They had no imagination at all. And then when there was a new cook there, who did actually try to do something with the vegetarian food, she left it.
Ah, dear.
It was Lamora, I don't know. I think she was doing it as a protest against things in general.
Mm. Were your parents, both of them, really quite sort of self-denying in a way? I mean, did they... were they economical with themselves and not spending a lot of money on themselves?
No, no. We used to have lovely holidays. I remember once going down to Westward Ho. We had two first-class compartments reserved all the way from Middlesbrough. We eventually, and I don't know, we must have changed en route, because I do remember standing watching, looking at the engine. And we took the governess, I think it was Miss Ramsay, with us. And we took over a boarding house there, practically, near the Golden Bay Hotel, as it was then. I think now it's a horrible area for caravans, now a holiday centre. But at the time, it wasn't the Golden Bay Hotel that we were at, but it was a guest house just nearby, and they went vegetarian, especially for us.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and father played golf. Course, it's quite a good golf course down there.
Your mother was quite a key
golfer. Oh, yes, she played golf regularly. And they played at Westward Ho, and we went down onto the beach and along the Pebble Ridge there, and I've got photographs, I think, somewhere, but with Miss Ramsay. Now, this must have cost the earth. We had 6 weeks there. Then there were other times going to Whitby, we stayed, and Saltburn, we regularly stayed for weeks on end, and they would spend a lot of time golfing.
Was that your mother's main sort of recreation, really, would you say? Or?
She played until the bankruptcy, and they played tennis. We had a tennis court in the garden, and we had a lot of tennis guests, and we had regular tennis parties. They had a lot of guests. They must have spent a lot of money. Mm. And
all that entertaining that you mentioned.
Yes. We had a croquet lawn.
Did you have it?
Played croquet.
Mm. Not many people live like that nowadays.
There was the tennis court and the croquet lawn. We're side by side. And I always used to marvel at my mother playing tennis. Because she was a hypochondriac, and I always thought that she was filled with aches and pains. But in fact, when I played tennis with her as a girl, she always used to beat me. So she must have played reasonably well. She would never let me win.
Did she ever take you to the Minerva Club in London, actually? Because your sister remembers going to the Minerva Club.
Yes, this was the club that I talk about. Yes. I went up to London with her when I was 11, and I had a lovely holiday in London alone with her at the Minerva Club. We went to everywhere that one takes a child of that age to. She was a wonderful guide through London.
Was she really?
She made London live for me. Mm-hmm. And about the same time, about a year later, she took me up to Edinburgh, and we stayed... I've forgotten the name, in Liberton. It was a place where there were friends, suffrage friends of hers there. And she took me again around Edinburgh. We spent about a week in Edinburgh, or a fortnight in Edinburgh. And we used to go in those horse-drawn cabs, open, what are they called? Those vehicles, along Princes Street, they used to be, and
yes, I don't know. Not a brougham.
It was open, yes. And I remember the driver, the horseman, took us round two or three times. We went in different directions in Edinburgh, and every corner he told us about the murders, the historic murders that had been committed. And this was the most wonderful visit to Edinburgh, just with her. Mm. I was alone with her to London and to Edinburgh.
Mm.
And they were wonderful times. absolutely wonderful.
What was the Lower Club like? Actually, can you remember it? Because it's so important,
I remember
but
small,
it's completely vanished now.
A tall building, narrow corridors, stairs going up, small rooms, long rooms, with a sash window at the end. These were the individual rooms, and each room had a carpet and a single bed, and I presume there was a dressing table. They weren't lavishly furnished, and downstairs, I can vaguely remember the place where we dined. Again, it was fairly bare, I seem to remember.
Exactly what your sister said.
Yes.
Slightly tatty, I think,
yes,
was what she said.
Yes, yes.
I
do remember the green and gold about the place. Those would be the suffrage colours,
that,
wouldn't
well,
they?
Well, there was Whigham League colours.
Yes, yes. Green and
green,
gold.
Green, white and gold.
Was it green, white and gold? I remember the green and gold a lot everywhere.
Was that so? I see. I didn't realise they had the colours there. Yeah.
That is what is in my memory, or whether it was from there. But it was at the Minerva Club that we stayed that time when I went up to London with her, and I went to the British Museum and the galleries. And
it was a natural place for your mother to go when she was in London, I suppose.
Yes,
I mean,
she always went up for all her meetings when she was on the National Executive of the Women's Freedom League, and she was president for a while. She always stayed there or at Kingsley.
Now, what's the Kingsley? That's
that was the twin hotel to the Bonington. The Bonington and the Kingsley. They were both run by the same company.
Vegetarian hotel?
No, it wasn't a vegetarian.
No.
And we all stayed at the Kingsley when I was away at school one Christmas when my father's business was going wrong and the newspapers were full of things that they didn't want us to see, and we didn't go home that Christmas, and we were at a boarding school in King's Langley, and so they took us around and we all stayed at the Kingsley that time. I mean, with things rocking as they must have been, it must have been hellishly expensive.
Absolutely.
To stay there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then we went on to my uncle, who lived in Berkshire, East Hendred in Berkshire. We went on for the rest of the Christmas holidays to that place. The Bonington and the Kingsley, there's some association I've got with, I can't remember what it is or why. Kingsley, oh, there's something about the Kingsley, I'm trying to remember. You don't
know why, I just wondered, you know, why she chose that one.
And, she and Daddy used to go and stay at the Savoy.
Did they really?
What's the other hotel?
Claridge's?
I know. The one... not the Savoy. It went down...
Ritz?
Yeah.
Go to all the best hotels in London.
It was the same as the Savoy. And it closed, years and years
Strand,
and years
Strand,
ago.
The Strand.
No, it wasn't the Strand. Surely there was another one, and my memory is sort of...
Yeah, because it may have been before my time,
yes.
Anyway.
And historically, it was open about the early days when the Savoy was the hotel, and there were the two hotels.
Browns?
No, you still haven't got it, and I can't remember. I know they stayed at the Savoy, though, quite a lot.
Did you ever see Lillian Lenton?
I've got a photograph of her here, in amongst these. And I saw her just a little while before she died. I went to find her, where was she living? Begins with T.
Again, I don't know.
Tottenham, would it be? No.
I remember you saying you went down. She was an old lady living in a flat, wasn't she?
She was living in a flat.
Can you give me a description of her life?
You were quite sad when you came.
I was very sad because I used to go around with Lillian Lenton a lot when she was organising for the Women's Freedom League around Middlesbrough, and she used to take me in her car. We used to go all over the place visiting people who were likely to help or where she could raise money, and she never had any money herself somehow. She used to go months without any salary for the simple reason that the league couldn't pay her. They had no money to pay her. But she used to write a little and get a little money that way. But she never resented the fact that she didn't get paid for what she was doing for the Women's Freedom League. She was so wholeheartedly part of the whole cause. And she too was a very feminine person. She introduced me to cosmetics. My mother never bothered with those, but she used to use them quite a lot. And she sometimes made dresses for me to make me feel a little bit more feminine, when, particularly when hard times were a little bit hard and we couldn't afford any clothes, and as my mother never made any, and I hadn't sort of started making them myself then, she had did make quite a number. She took me up to Rothsay too, and she got me to help with the annual campaign they had at Rothsay.
Yes, they did, didn't they?
And
yes.
I used to go and stand on the end of the pier or wherever it was where we used to have the meetings, and I would have to call to the crowd. She took me because I was young and, she said, attractive looking, and I would get the crowd. And as soon as I got the crowd, I don't know what I said to them, then she and the others, the hardened campaigners, would take over, and I'd just wander around with a collecting box. Needless to say, I didn't like it. I hated that campaign at Rothsay. I thought I was going to love it, but I wasn't that sort of person who could do that sort of thing, not like she could.
You didn't like the exposure, sort of thing?
No. But she did it willy-nilly, and she loved it. She loved a battle. And as I say, she was a wholly feminine person. She was a lesbian.
Was she? I didn't know that, actually.
Yes, she admitted so. One time. There was some man who was interested and wanted to marry her, but I remember her saying, I don't care for men that way, I much prefer women. And I don't think she actually said she was a lesbian, but I always took it that she was. And there was a relationship with someone called May Green. I'm telling you all sorts of things here which are probably quite impossible to
She certainly was eccentric, wasn't she? And I suppose if you were a lesbian in those days, you were rather frowned upon. Whereas now, I mean, it's just one of those things that happens to you, isn't it?
I think so. Well, there was this relationship with this person, Miss Green, who lived in Middlesbrough and was one of our paying guests. And I know they lived together for quite a while, and there was quite a long relationship together. Of course, this is something that you can't use, I know. My mother knew about it, yes. And then I went to visit Lillian Lenton years later. It must have been just a little while before she died. How long is it since she died now?
Four or five years ago.
But it must have been about 6 years ago then that I visited her in London.
Yes.
And she was lying back in the chair, her legs apart, showing, you know, all that she, her underwear and everything, and so absolutely the opposite to the trim woman that she had been. And she was speaking with a very deep voice, whereas before she'd always had a nice voice, but she was the sort of voice that you get with smoking, excessive smoking, and possibly drinking. And I was very, very sad when I saw her like this, but she did die soon afterwards. And she was querulous the whole time. Her sister was with her, looking after her, and her sister couldn't do anything right. Well, she was being absolutely wonderfully patient with her too. It was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to see. But she did keep on dwelling on her David Frost appearances that time.
She was interviewed by him, was she, on television?
On television, yes. She was his favourite suffragette. He used to call her his suffragette. And I think she had about three time she was with him on television. Didn't you?
Oh, she obviously had quite a lot of charm, didn't she? Because quite a lot
yes.
of people.
Yes, she her. Had, and this is why I found it so sad to see her. In
you think
state.
She just sort of let herself go,
absolutely.
Really?
And yet, my mother never did let herself go.
No.
Right on the last 24 hours, she was fighting against dying. She didn't want to die. She still had so much she wanted to do. And
she said that, did she?
Yes, there were her children, her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren, and she wanted to live to see all these things happening. And she wanted to die. Oh, this is odd, because she said to Ray that she was ready to die, she wanted to die, but she was afraid. She said, if only I could believe, that would be wonderful, but I can't believe. And she wouldn't take any sort of comfort from the minister or anybody in order to make her fear any the less of dying, because she couldn't believe that there was any life afterwards.
That was always the case, wasn't it?
Yes,
with her? She was always
this was with her, yes. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't, so many people, just convince themselves, just for comfort, you know,
yes.
to allay their fears, they would convince themselves, but she wouldn't.
Mm.
And that, combined with this not ready to go, even though she wanted to die, she wasn't ready to go, if you can understand what I mean. Because she was in pain, she wanted to die, but she didn't want to leave everybody. And she fought against it, and she should have been lying down in order to die comfortably. And she made me, and Marion was there too, lift her up, and I sat there holding her up, and while she was sitting up, she felt that she was putting off death, until the matron came and said to me, you mustn't hold her up, it's prolonging it too much. And the look on her face as I put her down was, you know, you're deserting me as well. It's lived with me for a long time afterwards.
Mm.
She certainly battled on.
Yes, that's quite common with quite a lot of them. They're marvellous people, lot of these women, I think.
But Miss Renton, you probably know a lot about her, how she went around
her.
The country. She told me many tales of how she set fire to certain things. She was wanted for arson by the police.
She was quite
yes.
in the thick of things.
Yes. Oh, yes. She loved doing all this thing. It was a tremendously exciting life. And then she went to Serbia. She went to save the
probably
children.
Probably a lot of them did.
Yes.
Yes.
And
she
suffered immense privations while she was there.
She talked about her old suffrage days with excitement, didn't she?
Yes. Oh yes. And she had to be forcibly fed when she was in
yes.
Prison. Was she in Holloway?
Yes.
I suppose
yeah,
she
all
was in Holloway.
All
they all went
months,
to Holloway.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
And
she got on with your mother, even though your mother disagreed with militancy, really.
They were extremely good friends,
mm.
very, very good friends. She was the one person, yes, who my mother did get on with very, very well. And she'd come back again and again and stay with us.
Mm.
She stayed for long stretches with us.
Mm. Well, that brings her to life a bit. I think your sister also gave me a picture of her, which is similar to yours,
oh.
but different as well.
Well, she drove a car.
That's right.
Erratically in the extreme. Didn't matter which side of the road you were on, and how she missed certain things, I don't know. Of course, those were the days possibly before there was a highway code. And I used to sit in this car with her, and it had a dicky seat, and I used to sit in the back sometimes when she got another passenger in all the foul weather. I used to sit outside with the dicky seat. I don't
she was
know.
Good with you, presumably. Mm. You
she was very kind to me. I don't know why she was.
Mm.
Because I don't really think I deserved it with her, but she used to do this, and I think she did it for my mother's sake, in order to... I wasn't bright at school, and she
well, so you must have represented the younger generation of women coming up for her.
Yes,
She must have had a feeling, sort of sentimental feeling, I imagine, about younger women. She'd been fighting for them after all.
Yes, and yet I often wonder why she did. She took me around. I think she felt too that, as you say, I was a young person, and it made her look as it linked her with.
Yeah, that's important.
Young people,
yes.
Yes, with other women.
Because the great problem with the Women's Freedom League, with all those things, is that they just don't recruit.
They were
the
older women, the old fogies. And I was talking to Malcolm Elliott, who was a senior lecturer on our staff this morning. I was saying you were coming, and he said, "Ah, oh, yes, he's very well known as a historian." And I said to you what you were doing, and. Malcolm said that I was to tell you that his grandmother was a suffragette in the early days, not a very active one. And once when he was a child, he'd asked his mother what suffragettes were, and she'd said to him, "Oh, they were a bunch of silly women." And Malcolm doesn't think so, but so.
Is your grandmother still alive? I mean,
this would be interesting to know. Would you like to talk to him on the phone? Because I can find him on the phone if necessary.
Well, I don't want to disturb him or you, but I mean, if you hear that she is alive, she might talk about what she knows.
I doubt if she is, because
probably
he must be about 40 now.
I don't know him actually.
One thing I do remember, which gives another picture of her. When Peter was at the university, he and Doreen, his wife, they were not married. And in those days, of course, living together unmarried was unheard of. Yes. And they didn't believe in getting married. They weren't going to get married. They were fighting against the establishment, and they set up home halfway between Leeds, where she was, and Manchester, where he was. And then he got his degree, and on degree day, my mother went over to Manchester to see him presented, and he took her to where he and Doreen were living. And she saw how they were living, and I remember her coming home and the great conference she had with Daddy when she got home. And I think it absolutely bowled her over, but she accepted it. You know, she did accept it, and it was, to someone with her upbringing, an absolute enormity that her son was living that way then, of course. Mm. Afterwards, Peter and Doreen got married when he went to teach at Wolverhampton, I think. You know, they were a bit against that way of life. And they did eventually get married, especially when just before Leon was born. But I remember the way she weathered the storm is the only way to describe it.
Because Mrs. Pankhurst herself didn't want to marry originally, Dr. Pankhurst. And Dr. Pankhurst said, "Look, you know, it's going to do you so much harm, it's going to do the women's movement so much harm if we don't get married, we just will." But I mean, really, until very recent times, it's been a thing one just avoided, that sort of thing, at least in one's first marriage. You know.
And then Christabel too. Was it Christabel?
Oh, well, no, that's Sylvia you're thinking of.
Sylvia
had a son, but never married the father, and nobody officially knows who the father is, though in fact I think he was an Italian refugee from Mussolini, actually. And that's the Pankhurst who's still alive, Richard Pankhurst.
And then there was a Professor Duff at Manchester at the time when Peter was there. Maybe you knew him. I think he went to Newcastle, or something afterwards.
Yeah.
Anyway, he greatly admired Peter, and one day he came over to us in Middlesbrough, and I was told afterward, I wasn't there at the talk, he went to see my parents, and he said to them that he greatly admired the way that Peter and Doreen were living their own lives. And he knew that there was great financial strain because of Daddy's bankruptcy, and I gather that he paid for Peter's, well, a certain amount of Peter's living, his grant didn't cover it, until he finished at the university, which I thought was a great tribute to Peter.
Your mother, I suppose, must have been very attached to him as her only son, was she? Or didn't she make any distinction?
Oh, she was attached to him, very much so. Some lovely pictures of him as a little boy with her at the around the goldfish pond and the sundown and things like that. She was very proud of him, always. And he felt that he had to look after her. It was his obligation to look after her.
And it was about him she would have stories about, like when he had a new Panama hat for school. He wore it in the morning, it came home crushed in his back pocket at night. And his snails and things he used to have in his bedroom, his mice. Not in, just in cages, sort of quite happily wandering.
And he used to take I remember he took a dead rat to bed with him once, beside his pillow. and he used to wake up with nightmares every night. He used to get somewhere in the middle of the night, before midnight I think it was, he would start to make the most blood-curdling screams in his sleep. This went on for years, and he wouldn't know anything about it, and she always went. No nurse, no governess, no anybody, always Mummy would go to him and calm him, and he'd go off to sleep again. And at school, he used to sleepwalk.
That's where Justine gets it from.
Yeah, it might be, mightn't it? Yes. But when we were at King's Langley, he was known to sleepwalk quite a few times.
Was he? So she really does the essentials as a mother very well, doesn't she? I mean, she may have servants and so on around a lot of the time, but on personal things...
She did the holy feminine essentials.
Yes.
Which made us love her.
Yes.
Very much.
Well, if we